Biting a ghost, catching a fox, the fornicating dog, friendship beyond the grave, the alligator's revenge, dragon dormant. Those are just some of the intriguing titles of Strange Tales from a Chinese Studio, a 17th century Chinese collection of stories in which beautiful foxes put spells on young men and mean daughter-in-laws are turned into pigs. I'm Emily Auerbach.
I'm Norman Gilliland. This is University of the Air.
What do Chinese tales of the supernatural reveal about Chinese culture and literary tradition? Joining us to explore foxes and ghosts, an introduction to the Chinese tale of the strange, is Rania Huntington, visiting professor of Chinese language and literature at the University of Wisconsin-Madison.
When Emily read through those titles, I was thinking into the 17th century in Europe and all, you know, the sort of things we get from Grimm's fairy tales eventually and so on. Same kind of thing. Must be a different tradition that we're going to be talking about.
It is a very different tradition. There are parallels that can certainly be productively drawn. One of the biggest differences, I would say, would be the sheer length of the written tradition that you're drawing on. I mean, I'm talking about authors who were writing in the 17th century and the 18th century, but this tradition of writing down strange tales had been going on since the 4th century AD. And that's young by Chinese generic standards, relatively speaking. So I'd say that would be one of the great differences. Another of the greatest differences is that often the Grimms or others would present themselves as collecting other people's stories, right? We're going out to the peasants. This peasant folk culture is being lost, and we educated people have got to save it. And this tradition of the Chinese tradition of collecting strange tales can have that element, but it's not just the educated author saying, oh, the peasants are telling this story. My nurse told this story. My nanny told this story. They're also telling stories that have happened to themselves and that happened to their own upper-class friends and relations.
These transformation, animal transformations, they're saying this actually happened to me?
Well, they won't tend to say that the most extraordinary of things happen to them. There's kind of concentric circles of how close you situate the tale to you and how extraordinary the strange things that happened are, much like urban legends today, right? If you think of it, there's a lot of things that are at a friend of a friend sort of distance, right? But when you get to animal transformation, that's actually an interesting case because very few people will claim to have actually seen a fox become a person, to have seen the moment of transformation. But there were, in Qing Dynasty China, a great many people who were convinced that foxes moved in to empty houses and would be living in empty attics and in gardens and in empty storage rooms, and that most of the time they would be manifest by you'd hear strange noises, you know, the proverbial thing that goes bump in the night. But sometimes you would hear or glimpse other things. Sometimes you would hear them playing musical instruments. You'd hear the clack of chess pieces. Or you would see a human figure. Here's an example of personal experience or family experience. It's not about the foxes. It's about ghosts. This is a man named Ji Yun, 18th century figure. In his day, a very successful, very famous scholar, official bureaucrat, only now well known for his strange little collection of stories. When I was 2 or 3, I would see 4 or 5 little children wearing bangles and brocade who followed me around playfully, calling me little brother. They seemed to be very fond of me. When I got a little older, they no longer visited me. I later told my father. He pondered a long while and then said, "My previous wife deeply regretted not having any children and was always having the servants bring back shrine dolls outfitted in brightly colored silk. She placed them in the bedroom, gave them names, and fed them every day. It was just like nursing a child. After she died, I had them buried in the empty courtyard behind the house. No doubt these were your visitors. Fearing that they might turn into evil spirits, I planned to dig them up and get rid of them. But after so many years, I am unclear about their location." And there's a second half to the story, and I'll talk about this first. Now, we would listen to this story. Oh, when I was 4 or 5, when I was 2 or 3, I would see these little children who would play with me, and later they didn't show up. And we would say, imaginary friends. Here's right. a boy who's playing right. with his imaginary friends. And that is what we would tell our children when they came to us.
It.
And we'd say, oh, yes, yes, they're there. And later we'd explain that those are imaginary friends. You outgrew them. When Ji-yun goes to his father, telling him what he's been seeing, he gets a different explanation.
Right.
The one that kind of goes in one better. Yeah.
And he gets an explanation that is linking this thing the child saw to this piece of family history. Now, this previous wife of Ji-yun's father was also the elder sister of Ji-yun's mother. Ji-yun's father married a wife died without children. He then married the younger sister, the same woman. And this becomes relevant when I read the next part of this story. Other sources tell us that what she's doing here with the shrine dolls, dressing them up, this isn't just some strange thing a childless woman is doing. This is part of a ritual of praying to have children, of praying for fertility. So she's you know, it may be comforting her, but there's actually some hope that this is going to be efficacious and that she's going to have children. But from Ji-yun's father's point of view, this is potentially dangerous because objects that get a lot of human attention and human contact might become capable of assuming human shape and making trouble. So he thinks that the prudent course would be with things like this just to destroy them. They're obviously already manifesting themselves. The prudent thing would be to destroy them. He doesn't succeed. So we're left with this childhood memory, but which is also a memory for both father and son of this woman who's gone. Here's the other anecdote that Ji-yun records right after that with the dolls. My father's previous wife had been my mother's older sister, as I just said. On one of the anniversaries of her death, after the sacrifices were over, my mother took a nap and dreamt that her older sister was shaking her and saying, "How careless can you be, letting your son play with sharp blades?" She awoke terrified. I was sitting next to her and just then pulling my father's sword from its scabbard. Thenceforth, I knew that spirits did indeed return to receive sacrifices. This was why the ancients served the dead as if they were alive.
Okay, so if you're reading this story, other than the fact that it's originally in Chinese and using Chinese name, what signals do you see in it? What signs do you see that this is a Chinese tale as opposed to a European tale, an African tale? You know, what sort of elements might make it, I guess, identifiable in that way?
I'm not familiar with all the traditions of the world to the same level, so just an excuse on that. I would say the emphasis being put on the sacrifices. Yeah, that this isn't just dreaming of her any day. This was on the day of sacrifices in her memory. So she was coming back at a significant moment. I would say the way that Ji-yun draws a moral point from the story, because this he tells it to tell a strange story that happened in his family, but he wants people to learn a very Confucian message, you know, that sacrificing to the ancestors is really important. They're there as if they were living. So I think those might be markers. Not to say, again, that those ideas of continuity and relationship with the ancestors aren't present in many other world traditions.
How does that sacrifice usually take place? How is it usually expressed?
Well, here, there were many of my colleagues who study Chinese religion would be more qualified than me to talk about that, because I mainly read the stories. There would be very respectful offerings of food, often of liquor, of wine as well, of alcohol.
This would be at an altar?
At an altar, at a family altar that had tablets with the names of ancestors on them. And the living members of the family would, in order of their own seniority, bow low to honor the dead. Now, again, my colleagues in Chinese religion can talk to you in a much more concrete way about that.
I noticed in an article you wrote about Chinese tales of the supernatural that you start by talking about the problem of even that term, that supernatural needs to be strange and that there's a difference between it. And can you talk about that? Because, you know, if we're calling this our Chinese tales of the supernatural, maybe we should kind of try to figure out what counts.
Right. I think that is an excellent question, because the term supernatural presumes we have a natural world where we're all living and then there's something up there that's not, and we can draw a line between one and the other. And that's really not the traditional Chinese conception of these things. Now, in modern Chinese, you can translate the word supernatural back. So there is a word that translates neatly as supernatural, but that's not the way that Hu Songling and Ji Yun would have talked about these things. For them, they tended to use various words for strange. But this strangeness is still part of the natural world. The natural world is more all-encompassing. And there are things that don't happen all the time. There's things that you don't encounter all the time. But there are things that are marvelous, that people that are worthy of note, of worthy of comment. But they're still contained within the same circle of reality. And I think this leads to something else that's striking about this tradition, the Chinese Tales of the Strange tradition, which is this is not once upon a time in a kingdom far, far away. These stories are situated in very real Chinese places. You know, places that you can go look up on the map, and you know, little villages in Shandong. There are, if they're in urban settings, some of these stories give you streets, give you neighborhoods where things are happening. Some of them are placed very clearly in historical time. You know, that this, not all, but it will be, you know, this happened in the 13th year of the Qianlong reign in the autumn. There's an intermingling of what we, from our contemporary perspective, would consider the historical and the strange, the other, that I don't think becomes terribly common in European literature until considerably later, as a deliberate thought experiment.
Is it sort of the magic realism idea?
Magic realism was a word that was on the edge. You can make some comparisons, but magical realism is still presuming that, often seems to presume that magic isn't entirely real. Whereas these stories are being written in a world where these things are possible. I do want to say a caution, though. I don't want to imply that these authors and their readers and their listeners believed every single story that they read or heard. There's an old, very old tradition of skepticism about the supernatural in China, of explaining, well, ghosts are all products of the human mind. You know, gods become gods because humans worship them. You know, these statements are made, very old texts. But the majority opinion, I believe, in Qing Dynasty China was that these things are possible. They could happen. But people also love to make up crazy stories about them. So you might believe some, but you would also, and Ji Yun in particular in his own recording will write down a story and say, I think my friend made this one up. It's still a good story, but, you know, it makes a good moral point, but I think this one.
Well, of course, an advantage of that from a kind of a salesmanship standpoint is that by implication, well, yes, now this one is made up by implication. The other ones I'm telling you are not.
Precisely that. Or there was often the protection of the friend of a friend urban narrative. You're not necessarily saying this happened. You're saying I heard this from someone. But even that is very different among different authors because Ji Yun is clinging what he thinks is the conservative tradition. I don't make up dialogue. I don't make up details. I would give you the tales that I heard. Hu Songling, on the other hand, is much more free with what we would consider fiction. And I think you can call it fiction with detail, with intimate dialogue that was only heard by the two main characters present, with characterization. So even within this tradition, there's a great range of fictionality and embellishment or relatively plain presentation.
What I noticed reading through a few of these stories, and I have to say this is totally unlike, I've not read any Chinese mm-hmm. tales, and I think most people have not. You know, mm-hmm. I see that there are some paperback collections now available of these tales. I think we're more used to, you know, Aesop's Fables or Grimm's or something, but that mm-hmm. we don't routinely encounter it. But I noticed how many of them were erotic, involving animals getting in bed and turning into naked women or strange things happening to parts of the body or, you know, they seemed...
Sound like excuses to me.
Yeah, it seemed...
Well, yeah, we'll get into that. Yes, there is a big area of overlap in the Chinese tradition between the erotic and the again, we could go back to the word supernatural, the fantastic.
In the vampire tradition in the West, there certainly is.
Yes. I think the Chinese tradition is even more extensive and more explicit about it. For example, the fox spirits. Let's get back to the fox spirits. Foxes were thought, when they reached a certain level of age or ability, to be able to transform into human form. Now, technically, they could turn into men, they could turn into women, but the ones the stories are most interested in are the young, beautiful fox women.
The foxes, as we say.
Yes, foxy lady, indeed. It does translate. And in contemporary modern Chinese, to call someone Hu Li Jing is to say that a woman is sexually loose, a vamp, to get back to the vampire comparison. There is this large overlap between the erotic and the tales of the strange. And you can think about that in a lot of ways. Many of my students will ask me, wait, aren't these just fantasies by men? Because we have majority male authorship, we have majority male readership. And I will say, well, yes, but then let's look at what kind of fantasy they are. The society in which these people were writing was one in which the arranged marriage was the norm. A man who had enough resources could, in addition to his wife, also acquire a concubine. A man whose wife had no children would actually be under a certain amount of pressure and obligation to do so in order that there could be a son. But for men of limited resources, and there were courtesans, there was legalized prostitution with everything from streetwalkers up to highly accomplished artists and performers who were the superstars of their day and can be in some ways compared to the Japanese geisha tradition. But all of these women required resources. You had to have money to marry. You had to have money to get a concubine. You had to have money to spend time with a prostitute of whatever class. And the fantasy of meeting a lonely ghost on the road, a beautiful female ghost on the road, or a beautiful female fox in the world, it's a fantasy about meeting an available woman with apparently no strings attached. No family who's got her guarding her honor, no financial requirements. It was the fantasy, but it was also the nightmare. Because there's really two versions of the man meets beautiful young thing who turns out to be not to be human story. One of them is the sexual parasite story. And this is where the Chinese tradition is more explicit than the Western vampire tradition. Because in the vampire tradition, the vampire is drinking your blood, and there's lots of implications of sex and romance in that, of this intimate act of blood. The Chinese tradition is much more literal. A man's semen is his vital essence. And if a ghost or a fox takes all of it, then he's going to die. He's going to get very sick and he's going to die. So it's just very literal.
No future for the family either.
No future for the family because she's not reproducing. She's taking all the semen and not giving sons. So it's all the destructive power of sexuality from the point of view of traditional morality, but none of the procreative power of sexuality. So that's the nightmare. And that's this sort of story's cautionary tale. You meet a young woman in the woods at night and it's the ruin of everything because you went with her. But then, and Pu Xiangling was really a pivotal figure in this, the idea of them as danger, of this being a dangerous thing, have been around for some time. Pu Xiangling wasn't the first, but he was one of the most influential in turning these women into romantic heroines, giving them happy endings and making them not parasites, but instead heroines who would end up saving the men, saving the family. And he allowed the demon lover to come home, get married, live happily ever after.
Still as a fox?
Well, that varies.
I'm just trying to dishpan hands.
Yeah, exactly.
I guess I'm trying to picture the happy ending for a fox story. Do you stay a fox?
Well, that's an interesting question because he has some stories where he kind of lets it happen. Because the thing is, we say fox, but by this point, there's lots of stories, and it's not just – and I wrote my first book on foxes, so this is the topic I can go on at great length. By this point in the stories, there's lots of stories about foxes where you never see a fox body at all. The people involved say, oh, yeah, we're foxes, but you never, within the confines of the narrative, have anybody change back. Ji-Yun makes a comment at one point when he's talking about what foxes are, and he says, well, humans and animals are different things, but – foxes, they're in between humans and animals. So foxes are at this really indeterminate status. So it might be easier, again, to draw on a Western tradition to think about the foxes as in comparison with some Western fairy traditions, right?
Oh,
they're not.
Or mermaids?
Mermaids, no? Perhaps. But mermaids, they have the physical boundary that they can't cross without great cost, as we all know from The Little Mermaid. That they're in this liminal realm. They can be almost human. And so thinking about an animal is not entirely accurate. You know, it's more being in this special category that's almost human, but just not quite. A little bit more or a little bit less.
And they can go back and forth.
They can go back and forth. This is, if you contrast it with Western werewolf traditions, this is seen as a voluntary transformation on the part of the fox. The fox decides to assume human form. It's often thought of as something that they only get to be able to do after they've either gotten very old or if they've been studying.
Why do I see a fox out there with reading glasses in the woods?
Oh, no, no, no. Gian has stories literally where his foxes are out reading the Confucian classics. No, he has fox students and fox teachers. Gian does that. But often it's perceived of in terms of kind of Taoist self-cultivation, a lot of meditation, self-refinement, and you can get to assume human shape. In some of the stories, they can't quite do it all the way. There's one of Pu Songling's stories, the tail's the hardest part to change, right? So they're human all the way, but they have to keep that tail concealed under the clothes. There's another story, not in one of these collections, but in one of the longer novels, that blamed the evil last concubine who was responsible for the fall of the Shang dynasty, said that she was really a fox. And the legend went that when she went into the palace, she'd managed to turn everything else into a beautiful human shape, but she hadn't managed her feet. She hadn't managed her little fox paws. So what did she do about those little fox paws? Well, she wrapped them up in silk, and she put really, really teensy shoes on. And she walked in this beautiful way because she had these tiny little paws in a human body. And all the human women looked and said, well, she's so sexy, I have to do that too. And that's the beginning of foot binding. Now, it's a legend, and only a couple Ming Dynasty authors wrote down that legend. So it wasn't the prominent, it wasn't even in the 17th century the dominant explanation for where foot binding come from. But it was a legend that was out there.
As good as any in terms of the logic.
More on Chinese Tales of the Strange when we continue in a moment with the University of the Air.
Wisconsin Public Radio is online at WPR.org. It's a way to stay in touch. You'll find program information, news features, archived programs, and much more. Visit us anytime at WPR.org.
Yi shi shi yue, yi hu ye. 以无心之德,而又思所报,而身受再早之福者,故失胜与迫葬,何其如哉,月切中重缘,从容而去,失之先人之情,一更胜又留俗也。
That's from the ending of one of Pu Songling's Strange Tales from a Chinese Studio. I'm Emily Auerbach, back with Norman Gilliland, and our guest is Rania Huntington, visiting professor of Chinese language and literature, reading from the Chinese. I have to ask you, because you're not a native Chinese speaker, but you have published books about foxes and strange tales in Chinese literature. What drew you into this world that was not the world that you grew up knowing about?
Well, I think you answered your own question. Right there. I grew up in Mesomanie, 25 miles west of where we sit. And I loved fairy tales, mythology, folklore, science fiction, fantasy from very early childhood. It was always my favorite form of literature. I also loved foreign languages. And when I was in high school taking German, it didn't seem quite foreign enough. And I read some Chinese literature and translation, actually not these things, but I read a translation of the Monkey King story, The Journey to the West, and was introduced, you know, fell all at once into this, you know, I who had been reading folklore and mythology and felt very comfortable with the world, worlds of Greek myth, Irish fairies, all my life, fell into this world where I had no reference points. It's like bodhisattvas, monkeys, peaches of immortality, foxes. I mean, it was this complete, obviously very rich and complex world. And between that and just being attracted by the difference, the otherness and the beauty of the Chinese language that I decided that I wanted to study Chinese. And I, yeah, it started, well, I bought a used Chinese reader from the year of 16. I bought a used Chinese reader from Paul's Books on State Street and started to try to teach myself Chinese. And I started to really study Chinese when I was a freshman in college, and I never stopped. And yeah, I ended up doing classical literature and focusing on Tales of the Strange.
You mentioned that the Tales of the Strange go back to, what, like the 4th century, 5th century A.D. Mm-hmm. Is there a real burgeoning, though, when we get to the 17th century?
Well, there had been rise and fall. There had been something of a resurgence. There had been kind of a lull in about the 15th century or so, a slowing down in the rate of publishing of them. And then in the late 16th and the 17th century, there was more publication coming out, kind of a resurgence. But Bu Songling's Strange Tales from a Chinese Studio, Liao Jiaji, is really one of those masterpieces that stand alone and reinvent the genre that they represent. I mean, he draws on the tradition. Now, it was never published in his lifetime. He wrote it in manuscript. It circulated among his friends. But it was published after his death. But once it was published, it was this best-selling, crazy success. And it was widely imitated. The stories were adapted to become plays. They were retold in vernacular Chinese. And it also had its critics. And Jiyun, the other collection I'm quoting for, he's one of the people who's quite critical of Bu Songling, both in literary and to some extent in moral terms.
What are some of the, I guess, underlying morals or themes that you find? You mentioned the one about you need to sort of sacrifice to the ancestors or be aware that their spirits are still with us. But what are some of the other ways in which you could read a tale and then extract from it some kind of meaning?
Well, one of the great principles, the central principles, is retribution and repayment. And this, that good will get repaid with good and evil will be repaid with evil. And this can be acted out on different frames. It can be acted out within this lifetime, that if you do a good deed for someone, that, you know, at the moment you least expect, they're going to come back and repay you tenfold or a hundredfold. But it's also in revenge stories, right? That if someone did you wrong, that will come back. But it's also enacted on from lifetime to lifetime.
So that if you do something wrong today, 3, 4, 5 generations from now, your descendant will get payback.
Probably be more immediate descendants, but no, your reincarnated self gets payback.
Oh. And how important is that idea of reincarnation to these tales?
It's quite important. I mean, it doesn't appear in every story, but it's certainly an explanation often for why things are happening. Well, here's one. And I won't read the beginning. I'll read in detail when it gets to it. Basically, Jiyun and his friends got together one night and they all told stories about foxes. And one of his friends is saying there was a man named Zhu who had a maid who was really kind of coarse and crude. But as she got older, she suddenly became beautiful, and she also got more discernment. She seemed to become much smarter. He took her as a concubine, and she was a really good household manager, and she was also really good at business. So she would always, you know, save something and then sell it when it was more expensive. So he became rich. Now I start reading instead of paraphrasing. One day she addressed him abruptly, saying, "Do you know who I am?" "Are you crazy?" he asked. Then as a joke, he used her childhood name and asked back, "You mean you're not so-and-so?" "No," she replied. "She ran off long ago. She's now married and has a child who's 6 or 7. I was originally a fox girl. 9 lifetimes ago, you were a great merchant and I was your accountant. I embezzled 3,000 pieces of gold. When I went to the netherworld, they punished me by turning me into a fox. I've tried for several centuries to improve myself, and fortunately, I found the true path. Because of my former complicity in your loss, however, I never achieved immortality. For that reason, when your maidservant fled, I assumed her appearance to serve you. It has been over 10 years now. What I earned for you should make up for what I previously cost you. I will now be leaving my human body, and when I have gone, I will appear in the form of a fox. Give my body to one of the servants to bury, and he will skin it for the pelt. Do not blame him for this. 4 lifetimes ago, he died of starvation. I had not yet found the true path and gnawed on his corpse. If he dismembers my body, perhaps my sin will be expunged. She fell to the ground and changed into a fox. A pretty girl, only a few inches tall, then emerged from the top of the fox's head and slowly departed. Jewel could not bear to give the corpse to the servant, so he buried it himself. In the end, the grave was opened by the servant. He peeled the carcass and sold the pelt. Jew understood that it was a case of bad karma. He simply heaved a great sigh.
It could get complicated when you've got several lifetimes of several different characters intertwining there. When it's a matter of retribution, does the person committing the crime, is he somehow aware of it? I mean, if you commit a crime several lifetimes ago and you're reincarnated as somebody who is relatively harmless, and yet still you can have this retribution visited upon you?
Yes, this bothered my students a lot. my students thought this was completely unfair. If you didn't remember what you did, why should you be punished for it? But yes, the assumption was that you were enmeshed in karma. Now, in the course of the stories, the normal human condition is you don't know, right? The normal condition is, you know, you don't know precisely what you did in a former life that you're suffering for, that you're being rewarded for. But of course, in the course of tale, but that isn't interesting in a story. In a story, it has to be the exceptional circumstance when you get the explanation. Understanding the bad karma is often the means for it being erased. Pu Songling has a story, which wasn't, I don't think it was one of the ones translated in this collection, of a very abusive relationship between a husband and a wife. And the shrew was a literary type in 17th century China. And they had started it as a love match. It looked like it was going to be perfect. But then the wife became, you know, furiously angry at every transgression and a great deal of physical abuse. And then it's realized in the end of the story that in their previous life, she had been a bat at a temple, a lucky bat at a temple. And he had been a young visitor to the temple who killed the bat. And so all this abuse she's been heaping out, emotional, physical, of every kind, has all been karmic repayment. But once
she literally is an old bat.
Yes,
or but, a bat out of hell.
Yeah, exactly, or a bat out of hell. All of this works, yes. But once she realizes this, then she reforms herself and becomes a good wife again. And when I try to talk to my students about it, one way of thinking about it, particularly in terms of relationships, nowadays, if we have a relationship with someone that doesn't make sense on a conscious level. You know, why am I attracted to this person? Why do I hate this person so much? Why do I let this person abuse me? Those sort of questions. We look to psychology. You know, we look to our childhoods. We look perhaps to biochemistry. You know, but for those hidden explanations for why are we humans in these complicated relations. But in the world of these stories, you look to your previous lives, right? If you have this incredible attraction to someone and you don't know why, well, maybe you and that person were something in previous life, and the same for the negative side. And I think it works in a very similar way, right? It gives you narratives to work with the emotions and the situations, the entanglements you're living with now.
Are some of them just so stories in a sense? In other words, you mentioned about the possible link to why the feet are bound.
Right.
You know, the sort of explanation for that. But are there some of these that would be equivalent to the just so stories that Kipling might have written about?
How the rhinoceros got
his horn. Yeah. Not so much in these collections. There will be some of that kind of this is how this place got its name. Not, again, this was very late in the tradition. So a lot of times, you find more of that in the collections from, say, the 4th century AD, that are explanations for where, you know, where silkworms come from, or, you know, why this mountain has this name, why did we perform this kind of sacrifice. These two authors, there's not as much of that kind of material.
Is there a sense, as we get through these cycles of reincarnation, is there a sense of betterment through these lives, or are we just kind of bouncing randomly from one position to the next in these stories?
Well, again, this is probably a better question for my colleagues in Buddhist studies than me. I think that there's certainly the hope of betterment. I think there's certainly the hope of divine figures, of bodhisattvas, of Buddhas rescuing us from this. On the whole, these are really short stories. They can be half a page long. Even Pu Songling's longest stories are novellas. You know, they're even in the English translation, 10 pages long for the long ones. So these tales tend not to be telling you a story of multiple, multiple lives. They give you one glimpse and perhaps, you know, this life, the next one. For that sort of vision of working through a lot of lives in succession for progression, you'd find that more in the long vernacular novel.
And when you say gods or Buddhas and so on, to what extent would you say these tales are about trying to come to terms with religion? And are the gods laughing at human beings? Are they interfering? Are they tricksters? You know, what are the gods?
Well, what are the gods? Oh, there's a new colleague in our department who could answer that question so much better than I, but you can have him on in a couple months maybe. These stories are dealing with religion. Neither of these books are religious texts in the sense of they are not being promulgated by people who were religious professionals. They can be very didactic texts. They're teaching moral values. Who are the gods? The gods don't show up quite as much in these two collections as the lesser figures, as the foxes and the ghosts. But the gods can be forces of justice, rescuers. They can bring salvation. You do have times when some of the great, very great gods, the Bodhisattva Guanyin, Guangong, who's sometimes called the god of war, you do have cases in these collections when they're intervening to rescue people or to right a wrong. Many of the gods were formally perceived to have been people. The very first story in most editions of Pusong Ling's collection is something called, an otherworldly examination. This is someone distantly related to Pusong Ling. Song Tao was the grandfather of my elder sister's husband. But in China, this sort of relationship did matter. But basically, he has a dream that he is summoned to the netherworld to take an examination.
Now, I've had that dream.
Right. But hopefully it doesn't end up quite the way his does. And the examiners in the netherworld are very, very impressed with his essays. Now, remember, this is the means of advancement for elite Chinese males. You have to study the Confucian classics well enough to take the civil service exam to hope for a career in government. You know, that is the path to success and fame. And here's this otherworldly vision of it. And they were so impressed with his exam, they say, there's a city god vacancy in Henan province. So and we think we're going to elect you. But he said, oh, that's a great honor. I couldn't decline. But he realizes that becoming the city god of Henan province means that his human life is going to end and he's going to die. So he says, my aged mother's in her 70s. There's no one left to look after her. Please, please, please let me nurse her to the end of her life. And then I'll gladly go take up the job. And they go and they look up. They check his mother's longevity file and they find it and they say, okay, she's got 9 years left. So, okay, all right, and then the god of war, Guan Yu Ming, says, okay, because of filial piety, which is the most important reason to do anything, we'll give you 9 more years. And he, you know, he goes back, he wakes up, and, you know, he had been lying dead, unconscious for 3 days. He wakes up. 9 years later, his mother passes away, and when her funeral rites are concluded, you know, he gets his affairs in order, retires to his chamber. He lies down and dies. And his wife's parents, at the moment of his death, they saw him approaching their house, escorted by a large retinue and riding a richly caparisoned horse. He came walking into their main hall, made them a formal bow of farewell, and went on his way. Not realizing that he was a departed spirit, they rushed out in great perplexity to inquire what it could mean, only to be informed that their son-in-law had just died. So they saw the relatives saw him going off to go become a city god in another province.
That, I think, is is an angle that you don't see in Western literature.
Well, I think that a thing that's different to make a big generalization, you can do more boundary crossing in more directions in the Chinese tradition than in the Western tradition. Humans can become gods. Humans can become, you know, they can die, but then experience apotheosis. That was a relatively orderly case. Sometimes it's the victims of violent death who get to become gods. Humans can become gods. Humans can become immortals. Animals can turn into human shapes. You can be reborn as all sorts of things. It's certainly once there was the Christian tradition, you certainly didn't want humans becoming gods, but you also had this limiting factor of the soul, right? Humans have souls. all the animals, all the fairies, all the mermaids, they don't. And, you know, no matter how human they look, there's that one absolute dividing line. But in a system of reincarnation, you don't have that one line. I mean, humans still have a very special place in these tales. It's not to say they aren't, you know, they're still written for and read by humans. So humans, of course, give themselves a very special place. But the lines are not drawn as firm, I would say, and traffic in multiple directions. Gods can and immortals can mess up and get exiled down to live a life in human form.
We haven't talked about dragons and dragons and more when we continue with University of the Year.
We want to know what you think. Your comments are important to us, and the audience services staff is ready to assist you. Get in touch with us anytime by visiting us at WPR.org. Click on Listener Feedback.
Dragon Dorman. Commissioner Chu of Wuling County was reading in an upper room when a heavy rain began to fall. In the deepening gloom, he caught sight of a little creature, bright as a glowworm, wiggling its way onto his desk. It meandered across his scroll, scorching the paper as it went and leaving a trail behind it, like a slug. Somehow he formed the notion that it must be a dragon and, lifting up the scroll in both his hands, carried it outside. There he stood in the doorway for some time holding it solemnly aloft, but the creature simply coiled in on itself like a caterpillar and refused to budge. "Have I caused you some offense?" pondered Chu aloud. He returned with the scroll and replaced it on the table. Donning full Mandarin hat and girdle this time, he made a deep bow and carried it out once more to the door. He stood beneath the eaves waiting, and finally the creature reared its head, stretched, and took off into the air above the scroll, whirring and emitting a great stream of light. It flew a few yards, then wheeled round toward the commissioner, its head now the size of a large earthenware jar, its huge trunk 20 or 30 hands in circumference. Round again it spun, and this time, with a rumbling roar, soared up into the heavens. Chu returned to his desk and retraced its winding trail to one of the bamboo boxes in which he stored his books.
Well, that's a pretty metaphor, I think. It comes from one of the Chinese tales of the strange, and our guest enlightening us in this fascinating area is Rania Huntington of Norman Gilliland, back with Emily Auerbach. What does the dragon mean in all of these stories? Is there a single or even overwhelming significance for a dragon?
You couldn't have a single one. Dragons, in contrast to the Western tradition, are primarily associated with water in the Chinese tradition. They're assumed to live under the sea, but they fly up into the sky particularly to bring rain. So they live under the sea. They can even live in wells or in rivers, in lakes. Dragons do have imperial associations. The throne of the Emperor of China is the dragon throne. It is, on the whole, in contrast to the Western tradition, when the dragon is often primarily a monster and primarily a destructive force, the dragon is very powerful, powerful and awe-inspiring, and certainly far from harmless, but a more positive than a negative vision. Dragons are also not quite animals. They are also assumed to be capable of human speech. This one was hanging out being kind of insect-like, but the dragons in other stories will often appear in human shape. A very common kind of folktale beginning to stories will be a fisherman catches a big, beautiful fish in his net and lets it go. We've heard this in the Western tradition, but in the Chinese tradition, that fish will turn out to have been a dragon in disguise. And it's the dragon who comes back and rewards the man for having let him go when he was in a fish shape.
And how important are the pictures of dragons? Did the pictures come first and then the stories about them? Because, it's, I mean, most of us do have pictures in our head of Chinese dragons.
Yes. I would say that the pictures are very important, that dragons are it's a very visual thing. Even the story I just read was very visual, the trail going across the paper, that coil. Even though the stories that I've been talking about were by highly literate individuals, you know, this was a society in which the majority of the population could not read, and the visual forms of these strange things were very important, especially to that large part of the society who didn't read. Dragons, people would primarily know probably from pictorial representations. Things like ghosts or gods, people also knew from the stage, that ghosts and gods appeared in plays. And so there were conventions of how they would be costumed, of how actors who were portraying such figures would move. People knew the gods from the figures in temples or from murals in temples. People knew gods or the demons they were driving out from popular folk art. You know, even peasant households would, particularly in like the 19th century, would every year at Chinese New Year, you could buy these special Chinese New Year's prints, these very colorful prints of auspicious gods or figures to hang up in your house and keep evil away for a year.
How big a part of these stories is possession and exorcism?
Possession and exorcism can be a very important part of the stories. This is one of the ways when ghosts are trying to communicate with people or when animal spirits are making trouble, one of the things that they do is take over bodies. Ji Yun has a story about his son. Ji Yun read somebody else's collection of strange stories. It was one of his relatives by marriage. And he's pointing out the way that this man got two of the stories about Ji Yun's family wrong. So he's correcting them. The second incident records what happened when my son Ruji was dying. And Ruji was supposed to, when he was dead, to have spoken in the voice of a merchant from Shanxi collecting debts, saying, pay back my debts. Regional dialect's very important here. One of the signs that someone's possessed is if they suddenly start speaking a regional dialect that isn't theirs. That is a strong marker that there's somebody else there. And China has a very, very wide range of regional dialects, sometimes within relatively narrow geographic distances. As for him speaking in the voice of a Western merchant collecting debts, this was really only some wandering ghost in search of a handout. When we tried to verify with the said merchant his name, address, and the dates and witnesses of the loans, the beggar was dumbfounded and departed. And when Ji Ruji had previously been sued by creditors, the Board of Punishments made a detailed investigation of his accumulated promissory notes. All of them were recorded, and this was not one among them.
I gather that in contrast to all of these spectacular goings-on in the tales of the strange, there is this solid anchor of bureaucracy, very day-to-day, plodding, mundane conduct of business.
That's very commonly observed about the visions of the Chinese other world, that it's imagined heaven and hell are big bureaucracies and there's paperwork and sometimes the paperwork goes wrong and it, and sometimes if you drop a little cash in the right quarters, things can go through more smoothly. There's very much that. Now, scholars of the study of Chinese religion have been cautioning lately not to take that too far, because for a while the argument was, all right, the Chinese imperial bureaucracy was such a compelling worldview that people couldn't imagine the other world any other way. So it's bureaucracy is everywhere. And in some extent, the bureaucratic metaphor is very powerful. It is one that's used a lot. But often the most popular gods and the ones that people really prayed to and cared about were the ones who broke the rules and were not the bureaucrats, were the ones who would tear through all the red tape and, give you justice on their own terms.
That's what makes it really supernatural.
Exactly. If you can cut through the bureaucracy. But yes, the bureaucratic metaphor, very often exorcism might be imagined in terms of, I have a document here requesting exorcism, I'm going to burn it and it'll go to the right places, and then the departments in charge will send heavenly generals to go get rid of the bad things.
How does exorcism, though, square with the sense of justice in these stories if these possessions, these visitations are for the sake of settling the score somehow? Isn't that short-circuiting the process to exorcise the vengeance?
Well, exorcism can often be placation, right? It's often, remember, Ji Yun's asking very carefully, okay, what's your name? What's your address? Are you really someone my son owes a debt, you ghost? And the implication is if he'd come up with good facts, you could burn some spirit money and pay off the debt, right? So that, yes, exorcism might be getting along around the rules, but it's often finding a settlement that's all right with its parties, acknowledging, all right, you have a debt, we'll give you the following, the following offering, and then you'll go stop bothering us.
So sort of exorcism through striking a deal rather than
plea bargaining.
Yeah. Plea bargaining.
Right.
And now that you're able to read them in the original Chinese rather than in the translations and so on, now that you've had enough time with them so that the exotic has become the familiar in a way,
right.
What surprises you or intrigues you or excites you the most about looking at a whole collection of Chinese tales of the strange?
It keeps changing. I mean, some of these stories I keep rereading and I keep seeing new things. The language, and Pusoling in particular, the language is still dazzling. You know, you just read it. It's like, you know, just turns of phrase and turns of concept. Right now, I'm getting very interested in, within the stories, kind of chains of transmission. You know, who's telling what to who? I'm working on a project right now about female informants in Tales of the Strange. I mean, men wrote them all down, primarily male readership, but there are stories in here that say, well, my aunt told me this story. You know, my wet nurse told me these stories, and I'm interested in the ways that women are imagined as tellers of stories or as listeners to stories, because there's certain stories of didactic intent that they, you know, Jean will say with great satisfaction, oh, yes, and after the women heard this, they stopped being mean to their nephews or whatever, you know, their orphaned nephews or whatever. So I'm very intrigued in seeing how the stories work for people within their families. I'm intrigued with relationships to memory. But I still, as I did when I was a little girl, I still just love this sort of thing. So there's sometimes not a very intellectual answer.
You write that traditional supernatural themes and motifs continue to be evoked in the literature and films of the People's Republic. I mean, I guess, do you find foxes and other things showing up or things from these tales from the 17th, 18th century still in contemporary Chinese culture right now?
Well, the pre-modern was a very different world, but I think you will still find certain ideas evoked about the ghostly, about things coming back. One example, the contemporary film that's quite well known in the West, Raise the Red Lantern, both the novella it's based on and the film are playing with an old idea of ghosts, especially female ghosts, of those who commit suicide coming back and making other women die the same way they died. Now, of course, in that film, the women aren't really suicides. The men are killing adulterous women. But it is very much playing with, oh, there's this evil room, you know, and women falling in to the path that the ghost of the woman, the last victim, the last female victim. So that's just one example that comes to mind.
Well, I mean, even something as simple in a way as Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon has
right.
a strong
right.
supernatural
well,
component.
Well, one of the female villainess has fox in her name. yes.
What goes around comes around.
Right. So, no, and it's very much playing the whole very popular kind of sword and sorcery film genre of Hong Kong, or the mainland, yes, is drawing more strongly on a vernacular tradition of martial arts fiction, but also on these ideas.
Our guest this hour has been Rania Huntington, and it's been one of those hours where you think, wow, where could we go from here? There's an entire world unto itself that you opened for us, and thanks for guiding us through a corner of it.
Thank you.
I'm Norman Gilliland with Emily Auerbach, and I hope you'll join us for the next hour of University of the Air. Hearing the Ancora String Quartet with some new theme music for University of the Air. The arrangement is by Tim Whalen, expressly for University of the Air.